I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another weekly live stream. I really appreciate Millennial Woes for filling in for me last week. It was an excellent show. I was traveling at the time. I am joined today by Carl Thorburn. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hello, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this is a last-minute impromptu decision on your part and mine, and I really welcome you to the show. We have a number of questions already, so I'm just going to dive into those questions. And the first question, I guess, is it's from Moikel. I think that's how he wants me to pronounce it, Moikel. Did you see that Bronze Age pervert just admitted that he was Jewish? What are your thoughts on that, basically? I don't know. I saw this tweet commentary back and forth, but I don't know if it's real or not, so I don't know what to think of it. Carl, have you seen this? Do you know if this is legit?
I think it's, I mean, I haven't seen the latest tweets from him, but I've kind of known for, I guess, about a year now or something, you know, his supposed identity. And, you know, he's been in the right, the dissident right, for so many years and kind of doing his own thing. And, I know that there's controversy around him for multiple reasons. It's not just the Jewish thing, you know, but I kind of lean toward, like, on the whole, I think, you know, on average, I think I still kind of like him. You know, I think he says a lot of, he makes a lot of interesting points and, you know, makes useful observations. So I don't think he's, you know, a cheap or a shill influencer for an anti-white perspective. But I think that, you know, as far as like a bridge between civic nationalists and ethno-nationalists, he's fine for what he is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't really, you know, just sort of knowing that he's Jewish, that doesn't automatically, you know, make me discount everything that he puts out. You know, now certainly he has said some stupid things and things that, you know, I would disagree with wholeheartedly, but, you know, I think on average he's a net positive.
I don't know, because I stopped listening to him a long time ago. I tried reading his book twice and I couldn't really get through it. I just didn't think it was very good. And I would look at his Twitter stream and I found like it was spamish in a way. And so I sort of tuned him out a long time ago and I haven't been really following. I just hear the chatter of people saying, oh, he's a neocon. I don't know what that means, etc. I guess the great question is he a gateway or a gatekeeper? You and I talked about this when he first started doing his Caribbean rhythms thing. You thought, does he have an Israeli accent? He was putting on this strange accent. So way back when we were thinking that he might indeed be Jewish, he also wrote some articles along the way that evinced entirely too much knowledge of Israel and Zionism. I remember commenting, I think, with you about that. He really knows a suspicious lot about Israeli history, certainly more than, you know, your average Yale political theory PhD. So I thought that was a little suspicious too. But my feeling is that the people were saying, oh, he's Jewish, or, you know, he's obviously Jewish because he had a Straussian education. Well, there are plenty of Straussians that aren't Jews. And so that wasn't necessarily a good argument. His dissertation advisor was Jewish. Well, it's hard to do a degree at a top university, especially a place like Yale, without having Jews on your committee. So I always treated that as a stretch, you know, not proven. But if this is indeed true, it certainly fits in with the pattern. But I sort of dismissed him, at least as somebody I wanted to follow a long time ago. And it wasn't based on whether or not he was Jewish. It was just, I just found his content to be spammy. The way I put it is I just don't think that beefcake photos and baby talk tweets are going to save the West. I think he, it just struck me as too much of this like Instagram lifestyle blogging stuff, you know?
That's a good way to describe him, actually. He's sort of well-suited to Instagram, I think. which, who knows, maybe that's why he appeals so much to, like, Zoomers, I guess. Despite not being a Zoomer himself, you know, he's I think he's bordering on Gen X, even as far as I know. But
yeah, he's got to be in his 40s, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a tendency, and there's a tendency in our movement, and I've noticed this even in myself, you know, over the years, is that once you kind of are familiar with like the history and the ins and outs of the JQ, you kind of develop this like hyper sensitivity to it, and you're like, oh my God, somebody's Jewish, you know, therefore, you know, I've got to immediately dismiss or immediately, you know, attack or whatever. And it's like, that's not necessarily always the case. I mean, with, you know, Bronze Age Perv, I like I said, there's some things he says, you just basically have to use your brain, you know, and there's some things he says that are stupid, some things he says that make some sense. But, you know, on the whole, I think you're right. It's sort of, it is really baby talk. And it's kind of like, it's kind of bordering, he's straddling the fence between civic and ethno-nationalism. And it kind of annoys me when he talks a lot about like castizo futurism and Latino, and, you know, it's like he's trying to kind of merge pro-white politics with, you know, mestizo and, you know, that sort of thing. It's, I mean, you know, I can see how that might work in some practical situations, but, you know, that involve voting and things like that. But ideologically, it's just kind of stupid. You know, I don't think it's a long-term thing that we should aspire to do.
Sorry, folks, I'm having some audio difficulties. People are commenting on it in the chat. In post-production, I hope it'll get more balanced, but I ran out and left my plug-in microphone, so I'm just using the laptop mic, and I guess people can hear the difference. My apologies. My fear about somebody like Bronze Age Pervert, and specifically the stuff about castizo futurism and whatever, is simply this. I don't want a workable right-wing multiculturalism. And that's what he sounds like he's trying to lay out. A workable right-wing multiculturalism is just death for the white race in the long term. I've been saying this for years. I was very, very harsh on people in our movement who were favorable to Ron Paul. My point was that, the way I put it, is that Ron Paul is going to create a society, if he got his way, where the brown people who inherit America will have sound money and a non-interventionist foreign policy. And I don't want that. I would rather have highly inflationary policies that would drive our current system to the brink of ruin than sound money policies and workable, socially conservative, law and order multiculturalism, because that deprives us of one of our chief allies, namely the instabilities created in the system by multiculturalism. That deprives us of that ally in changing the system so that we can have a system where white people's long-term ethnic genetic interests and survival are simply sacrosanct. And we simply can't survive in a stable multicultural democracy. And so when all these people who are sort of adjacent to us get excited about the idea of a multiracial working class populism or something like that, it's like, no, maybe in the short term, if we want to get somebody like Trump elected, but the GOP is not our party. Trump is really not our guy. He's just a stepping stone down the road. And honestly, my greatest fear would be something like stable multiculturalism, or even worse, a dictatorship of somebody like Trump, who would basically make it impossible for us to militate against multiculturalism. That would be a real death sentence to white people. So I look upon people who talk this way as a danger. I don't want their solution to work. They think that this is a good solution. They think that they can save what they want if they just have a more conservative multiculturalism, maybe a little more race realist multiculturalism, pro-law and order multiculturalism, less debauched currency multiculturalism, closed borders, all that stuff. I don't want to make multiculturalism work. And my fear is that simply imposing right-wing policies in a multicultural society isn't going to work. And it's especially not going to work in dislodging the power of the hostile elite that has engineered us into this situation. It would simply be a circulation within the hostile elites from the crazed people, the Merrick Garlands of the world, to more sane people like West Coast Straussians, civic nationalists, populist types. These people are not my people, and I don't want them to be in charge. I don't want them to make a system where white people are being gradually replaced by non-whites, and Jews and Jewish-adjacent people, people who think like Jews, are still in charge of things on top. That would be death for us.
Right, right. Well, you know, civic nationalism has contains within it the seeds of its own destruction. If we saw, like, in polling, some evidence or indication that non-whites were shifting over toward sort of Ron Paul way of thinking and libertarianism and even voting Republican, then they would have a case to be made, at least a case on the basis that's like, you know, what's possible and practical in the medium term. But even there, it's we don't really see that. And so, yeah, we just, you know, and that's the thing too, is we need to, it's fine for white advocates to have alliances and, you know, friendships with people, you know, like Kanye or, you know, other races who are sort of adjacent and have similar goals. But it does, you know, that certainly doesn't mean that ultimately we're seeking a state solution where they're part of the situation. And there's a term for it. I'm trying to remember where the term is that Jews always use. It's not, it's not sovereignty, but it's similar. Oh yes. Self-determination, you know? So I think that that's what we need to be looking at is, you know, white self-determination is the, that's the key word, you know, and in order to have that, you can't have your polity and decision-making positions polluted with non-whites.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We can have allies, but they're not us. And ultimately, they can't be ruling us and they can't be running things, or we haven't achieved sovereignty or self-determination. And that's really the goal of white nationalism. I do think there can be non-white allies. I think Kanye West is an example of somebody who right now is objectively an ally. And Gadius Maximus wanted us to comment a bit, share some of our thoughts about the Kanye situation. I guess we're in the third week now of Kanye speaking out. He went from wearing White Lives Matter t-shirts to talking about the Jewish question. He is now being attacked and canceled, basically being shamed for saying that Jews are really powerful and influential. To show how wrong he is, Jewish organizations are flexing their muscles to cancel his career. And we have a guy who's was a billionaire a few weeks ago, and now people are gloating that he's not a billionaire anymore. So what is it? Are Jews a helpless, more sinned against than sinning minority? Or are they the powerful and vindictive and Machiavellian people that Kanye West says? Well, their mouths say one thing, and their actions say something entirely different. So I think this is a huge, what Barack Obama would call a teachable moment, right? This is extremely useful to us, and it has the attention of tens of millions of people, and people are seeing Jewish power being flexed in real time, and Jewish hypocrisy and Jewish intellectual dishonesty also flaunted in their face. It's extremely educational, and I admire the guy for being courageous, or maybe just foolhardy enough to actually do this, and I'm delighted by it. And that said, I don't think that we should put it this way. I'm not a Republican. I was not banking or hoping or praying for a based Black person to save us, but if a based Black person or relatively based Black person with a huge audience is going to say some of the things that we're saying, more power to him. I'm going to declare him Countercurrents official non-white ally of the year. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is sort of Kanye West's Leroy Jenkins moment. It's where he just sort of runs in and guns blazing, and we're all just kind of watching him from a distance, with our jaws agape. It's actually fascinating to watch this play out in real time, because you kind of get the sense that Jewish elites kind of got together and were like, okay, how do we deal with this situation in a way that's, going to be as good damage control as possible for our side. And so they got Piers Morgan to interview him. And, Piers Morgan's entire job is just to get white men to apologize. That's his, that's on his resume, is like his top skill, I guess. And so, but Kanye gets on there. He tried to get Kanye to apologize. And he refused to do it. He refused to back down, which was kind of stunning, And then Kanye went on the Lex Fridman podcast quickly afterwards. And then Lex did this weird thing where he wanted to get Kanye to say, well, it's not all Jews. It's just these particular individuals. And Kanye refused to back down there too. And then Lex said, well, you don't trust me because I'm Jewish. What, surely you have to trust me, right? And it's just so strange because Kanye, if you know anything about what's been happening in his personal life for the last, several months, pretty much everybody close to him has betrayed him, including his own wife. And everybody's just dropping him and canceling contracts, and all of his friends are distancing themselves from him. And so then out of the blue, this Jewish podcaster acts like he's entitled to Kanye West's trust. It's just the whole thing was such a sham. And so obviously, it was an obvious effort to create this kind of emotionally tense moment in the podcast where Lex Fridman is, like a puppy dog, begging for Kanye's trust, and Kanye wouldn't give it to him. But it just came across as really entitled and just stupid. And they gave him multiple chances to renege and to back down from his comments. He never took them. And so their plan is failing. It's not working out like they had hoped. But, Kanye is not very articulate, so he's not able to really convey the message he's trying to get across, which, as far as I can understand it, is basically that he does not like the fact that Jewish businessmen tend to insert themselves as the middlemen between Black artists and their audiences. That's kind of as far as like the social scope of that, that's really not that big, because, he's really only talking about the music industry. He's not talking about wider politics. Although at one point he did mention like Jared Kushner as sort of an example of Jews having power everywhere.
He basically said that it was Kushner who ruined the Trump administration, which is true in large part. If anybody besides Trump ruined the Trump administration, it was definitely Jared Kushner as court Jew, whispering in Trump's ear all the time and giving him bad advice. Of course, some of that bad advice included stuff that Kanye West was pushing, like sentencing reform, releasing lots of criminals from jail. That did not work out well. And Kanye does have a bit of blood on his hands for that, to be perfectly honest. Ultimately, it's all Trump's fault because he didn't say no.
Yeah, this whole thing is very confused. But, the way I look at it is like, it's unreservedly good for us. And, the reason is because it's kind of like, I've always said, there's something about human psychology and advertising and just the way people kind of take in ideas and concepts is it's really about repetition, right? And the first time you've heard of a new idea or concept, it just kind of rolls off of you. And then the second and third time you hear about it, you start to give it more consideration. And then the fourth and fifth time you actually start to look into it and you start to research it. And that's the way advertising works. Advertising is about repetition. And in this case, this is yet another example of a big shot, famous Hollywood billionaire, the first time in recent memory was, I guess, Mel Gibson. But this is yet another example of a big shot coming out and saying, hey, you know, Jews have an insurmountable power advantage in business and politics. And, you know, people can ridicule it all they want. And that's sort of the way I think that they try to camouflage it and save themselves is, you know, they'll ridicule Kanye and say he's off his meds or he's bipolar and sort of things like that. But the fact of the matter is that the more people hear about this idea over and over and over again over the years, the more it becomes a mainstream concept. And so, you know, it's Kanye is just yet another example of this idea. And who knows how many millions of people are going to be red-pilled, and it's not going to be instant. You know, I think that it'll happen over the course of, you know, the coming year, we'll see a lot of blacks and other people who are just fans of Kanye West will start to look into this and will start to, they might stumble upon, you know, Kevin McDonald and others and see an actual academic analysis of what's happening. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting. One thing that I think is definitely happening is a lot of people are squirming. A lot of people in the establishment are squirming because there are a lot of people in the establishment who, I think it was Tim Murdoch, Horace, who said that during his entire life, and that's certainly true of my entire life, the political debates in America have basically been between two groups of people vying with one another to love Black people the most, right? To show how they love Black people the most. And that's certainly true with the establishment. And one of the things that the establishment loves to do is they love to get pictures with Black celebrities. Now there are countless people. I don't know what percent of the 1% have pictures with Kanye West floating around there on the web. And a lot of these people are cringing with embarrassment about this whole thing. But guess what? In a week, in a month, in 2 months, they're going to realize nothing's happened to them. Nothing's happened to them because they were friends with Kanye. And that's going to embolden them. One of the reasons why, of course, this is being done to Kanye is because they want to intimidate other wealthy, powerful, influential people to shut up and not say anything about this. And of course, in the short run, it's going to have that effect. It's definitely going to have that effect. Kanye himself is probably wondering if maybe he messed up. But in the long run, he's going to still be around. He might have to do things like Mel Gibson did, you know, create his own companies and distribution networks and things like that. But Mel Gibson's still in the game and hugely wealthy and influential. There's no reason why Kanye West can't be around in 5 years, 10 years. And that is terrifying to the establishment because they want to be able to take people like this down. They want every billionaire to live in fear. Years ago, when Mel Gibson cucked out at the last minute and cut a line from the Passion of the Christ, this commentator on the VNN forum, who went by the name Nathan Bedford Forrest, said, "How many hundreds of millions of dollars do you have to have before you can give these people the finger?" And it's a great question. How much FU money do you need to have before you can say FU to the ADL? It's got to be a lot. And We're finding out it might take billions, but you know, everything over 500 million, it doesn't make any difference to your lifestyle. No. So anyway, he's not going to suffer in the long run in the least. And a lot of the people who platformed him, had their picture taken with him, et cetera, are not going to experience any blowback from this. They're not going to experience any embarrassment from this. And that's going to embolden a lot of them down the road, I hope.
Well, I think if Kanye manages to kind of spin this into a positive in the same way that Mel Gibson did, because, you know, Mel Gibson, I haven't seen what his net worth is recently, but it really took off after Passion of the Christ. And, you know, that was after he made his comments. But, you know, yeah, that would be amazing. I would love to see Kanye, you know, I was saying he should put out his best album of all time, you know, and if he puts out a really good album after this, then, you know, which he could, because, you know, it doesn't require you to, you know, you don't need a whole lot of money to produce an album. You know, it would be something that's sort of undeniable. You know, I think music sort of speaks for itself, and people would say, yeah, this is really good music, and they would want to play it. But, you know, I guess the radio stations might not play it. That'll be very interesting to see what happens if radio stations decide to boycott him. But it's just the next year or so is just going to be so interesting. We're really in interesting times, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another billionaire. Is our friendship with Elon Musk? We were friends with him when he was promoting Bitcoin. Then he started saying bad things about Bitcoin, and our friendship was either off, or certainly he was on probation. The Twitter thing happened. I was getting excited by it. Then it looked like it wasn't going to happen. I felt like Charlie Brown being taunted with a football over and over again. So I started tuning it out, and then boom, it happened. And one of the first things that happened after Elon Musk took over is he fired the CEO and the chief censor, and he reinstated Kanye's Twitter. Apparently Trump is going to come back on Monday. That's the latest that I've heard. There are people like Taylor Lorenz who are reeing and screeching about this. Taylor Lorenz said, "The gates of hell have been opened by Elon Musk." The gates of hell, meaning basically, I guess, our mouths, your mouth and mine, your ability to express yourself on Twitter and mine are the gates of hell for these people. I hope that he succeeds. I want to see Jared Taylor back on Twitter. Apparently, he was trending on Twitter the other day. I want you back on Twitter because you were fantastic on Twitter. I think that would be absolutely fantastic if that could happen. So I have a Twitter account that was set up for Countercurrents that was taken down a couple of years ago. I had my personal account, which has, you know, about 1,800 followers right now. And that account was recently given a strike for exercising protected political speech. I said that I supported the death penalty for a certain category of crimes, and this was treated as verboten because it was determined to be harassment. And I wrote back to them and I said, this is protected political speech in the United States, which is my homeland. Anyway, there's some countdown before I can tweet again. But as soon as I can, I'm going to tweet a screenshot of this to Elon and say, is protected political speech in America free again on your platform? I'd like to know. I am going to apply to get my old account back because basically it was taken down by people, by me. I think it was basically taken down. It's a suspicion because I was tweeting at people who were saying things like nobody needs an AR-15 by sending them pictures of Gade Grosskreutz, you know, dropping his gun as with a painful AR-15 shot to his bicep. And I just pointed out that, well, Kyle Rittenhouse needed an AR-15 for self-defense. And that was... That really, really burned a lot of these people up. And I think they started mass flagging my account. But again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with what I was expressing. It was simply an example of a historic example of somebody using an AR-15 in self-defense, which these nitwits were denying was necessary.
Yeah, that was a settled example. That's kind of like how when the left says, we had a war about this, remember?
Yeah, yeah. We had a trial about this, remember?
Right.
Yeah. So I have a question from a Shum here, and he wants to know, was Judge Doro degrading the dignity of the court by allowing Daryl Brooks to keep it real, talk over her, complain that she was not showing him respect, or was she helpfully providing the viewers direct evidence of how backward Black criminals are? Good question. What's your thought on that?
I'm glad she did what she did. I think I would have played it the same way. Now, you know, I don't, you know, when you watch the footage of that trial, it's obvious that she is sacrificing a little bit of her own mental health, you know, in allowing him to, to be his own lawyer, but yeah, I'm happy she did it.
I agree. I think she let him hang himself, basically.
Right.
She gave him all the rope. He can't claim that he was denied his right to defend himself. He was given quite a lot of rope. He hanged himself. He was found guilty. Unfortunately, he can't literally be hanged in the state of Wisconsin, but he hanged himself in the sense that he was guilty on every single count. I wish, of course, that there were hate crimes enhancements. I don't think there's going to be a federal hate crime suit passed down by Merrick Garland anytime soon, sadly. But
that can come later. And that's the, that's the beauty of this, is that even though he is, you know, he is convicted and I presume going to spend the rest of his life in jail. Yeah, we can always bring the hate crime charges at some point in the future.
Yeah, just for a show trial, just for fun, you know, just to drive a stake through his heart.
And in the meantime, he serves as an awesome example that we can point to of, you know, a double standard when it comes to the application of hate crime legislation. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, it's a win-win. So Sutton writes in, Greg, what is your favorite holiday and why is it Halloween? I think that's a great question. It's a somewhat leading question. Actually, my favorite holiday is Christmas. I'm on the record as saying that my favorite holiday is Christmas. I do like Halloween a lot. I enjoy it a lot. But actually, Christmas is my favorite holiday. Carl, what's your favorite holiday and where does Halloween fit into your ranking of the major holidays?
My favorite holiday is actually the 4th of July. And I think it's because of the time of the year that it comes in. It's like there's no other major holidays, you know, in summer. And so I just kind of like that. And I love the fact that we in the U.S. celebrate with fireworks. There's something about fireworks that I really enjoy. You just know that if fireworks had been invented recently, that they would have already been banned. So
yeah, right.
I love the fact that they're, you know, it's just sort of the libertarian in me likes it. And also I like the time of the year. But I think Halloween comes in number two for me because I think that I love the pagan aspect of it. And I just love the fact that it kind of creates a little bit of community because, you know, when you take kids door to door trick or treating, it's community building exercise, basically. So that's great.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I like the history of Halloween. There's a video that we link at Countercurrents every Halloween by Hugh MacDonald on a history of Halloween as a European holiday, which I highly recommend. So just search for Halloween in the search bar at Countercurrents and that will come up. I highly recommend it. You actually had a question for me before you decided to just come on the stream. So I'm going to answer that question and also give you a chance to answer it yourself. You asked, what are my favorite horror movies? And I think it's a good question. And since it's Halloween and ghosts and goblins and scary stuff, it's an apropos question. It's a seasonal question. So anyway, I jotted down a few answers. And while I'm giving this answer, you can jot down a few of yours. I actually don't like horror movies per se. I do like creepy movies, though. I like creepy movies with supernatural dimensions to them. I don't like horror as such. I don't like slasher movies and things like that. That stuff just revolts me, frankly, and it's not my idea of entertainment. But I do like a certain amount of supernatural horror movies, as long as they're suspenseful and interesting. I could think of 9 just off the top of my head. So I'm just going to run through them. One is Rosemary's Baby, directed by Roman Polanski. I think it's a brilliant mystery movie that becomes more and more supernatural by the end. And I thought it was really well done. I really like a movie that was directed by Jack Clayton in 1961 called The Innocents, which is an adaptation of Henry James's The Turn of the Screw. It's a ghost story. It's very effective. Carl Dreyer's 1932 movie Vampyr is one of the most amazingly suspenseful and stylishly created vampire movies I've ever seen. It's remarkable. From 1922, I like F.W. Murnau's original Nosferatu a great deal. I also like Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula from the 1990s. There is a wonderful Japanese movie from 1968 called Kuroneko, or The Black Cat. It's a ghost story. It's extremely spooky and effective. From 1964, another Japanese movie that I love is Masaki Kobayashi's Kwaidan, which is a collection. It's about 3 hours long. It's a collection of Japanese ghost stories. And it's very, very atmospheric and spooky and just lovely. There's a movie in recent years. I'm forgetting the author or the director. It's The Witch. It's directed by the same guy who directed the Northman. I think this is actually quite an effective, scary movie. It's a low-budget movie. It's done with great taste and intelligence, and it's very effective. And another movie that I love that's a scary film is Ridley Scott's Alien. It's effectively a haunted house movie, even though it's a sci-fi setting. I just think the atmosphere of that, the sets, the special effects, the creature concept are brilliant and enormously entertaining. I really, really love that movie, even though it is very creepy and very scary and horrifying in places. I actually had nightmares after I saw that the first time. So anyway, those are 9 scary movies that I like. I couldn't come up with around 10. I'm sure I'll have an afterthought later. Carl, do you have any scary movies you want to recommend?
I actually haven't seen that many horror movies just because I have to be kind of cajoled into watching them. I really liked Sunshine, which is some people don't really consider it a horror movie. It's like a science fiction film about a team of astronauts it's in the future. Basically, the theme is that the sun is dimming, and in order to save the Earth, they have to somehow get a ship near it and then launch something into the sun to cause it to flare up again and become brighter again. And in the process, there's a monster-type situation on board the ship, and it's really good. And then there's another horror movie that I enjoyed, and I thought it was terrifying, mainly because I kind of have a little bit of a claustrophobia myself, but it's built around claustrophobia, and it's called The Descent. And it is a movie about some young people who go into the Appalachian Mountains, and they find a cave, and they decide they want to go down into the cave and sort of explore it. And there's, of course, these demonic, twisted, human-like creatures down there that chase them around the cave, and it's pretty frightening. And then there's It Follows, which is an awesome film, and there's a review of that on Countercurrents Now, which I thought was good. And for those who don't know, It Follows is about it's not like a ghost. I think it's more like a spirit or something that basically is. It's going to sound funny when I describe it, but it's in the context of the film, it's not that funny. But it's like a sexually transmitted ghost, and when somebody would have sex with somebody else, instead of following that person, it starts to follow the other person that they had sex with, and if it manages to catch up to them, it kills them. And so basically the theme is that whoever it's following has to continually be on the run in order to get away from it. And then I really love the Paranormal Activity movies. I thought that those were great films because they're kind of mundane. It just sort of takes place in suburbia. And but the fact that it involves like a supernatural spirit is entertaining. And then there's 2 Asian films that I liked a lot. One was called The Host, which is a Korean horror film. And it's about this strange monster that comes out of the river that's flows through Seoul in Korea. And it's just very entertaining. And I think part of the reason I like it so much is because it has a pro-family message as well as being horror. And then the last one is The Grudge, which is just a very strange Japanese horror movie that I saw in college. It was I don't remember too many details about it, but I remember finding it very entertaining.
I just thought of number 10, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Boy, what a dope I am to forget about that one. That is a very effective ghost horror movie. I love The Shining. It's gorgeous to look at. It's extremely atmospheric and scary. So yeah, I like The Shining too. And that is, I think, Kubrick's best film. A lot of people love Kubrick. I'm not that crazy about him. I think he's a very talented filmmaker, but I'm not crazy about a lot of his films, but I do think The Shining is his best film. Those are all cool. I have not seen any of those, Carl. So that's
really
interesting. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I'm not a person who goes for scary movies as such, but sometimes when I see him, I like him and I want to see him again. So
yeah,
it's funny because I'm not, you know, I don't really consider myself a believer in like spirits or ghosts that would actually harm people. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if I watch a really scary film, I'll, for the next day or two, I'll be, you know, constantly thinking about it in the back of my mind. So it's almost like you're, it's human instinct, you know, no matter how materialist you are, I guess, you still sort of look over your shoulder when it comes to things like that.
Komi Kobayashi wonders, can we have Kanye's United States citizenship count closed on the basis of race? Yeah, sure, why not? I would like Kanye to live in a black homeland someday, not in the US. In the meantime, I'm delighted that he's helping us out by getting some of the issues that we think important talked about and getting our enemies to basically damage themselves because they have difficulty controlling their behavior. I think it's very, very useful, and I'm not going to deny it. Okay, Archie writes, Carl, is the 1999 book entitled The Sovereign Individual by Rees-Mogg and Davidson overhyped for the crypto enthusiast? Is there a more relevant book today? And he gives $3. Thank you very much.
Oh, interesting. The Sovereign Individual. Okay, I don't think I've read the book, but I know what you're talking about because there was a back years and years ago when I was reading Zero Hedge very closely and I was libertarian. There were a lot of these guys who were, I don't want to compare them directly to like the masculinity gurus that are on Twitter today. They're kind of like the progenitors of that in sort of the libertarian style. There were people who would advocate for basically young men who were libertarians in the US to renounce American citizenship and, you know, go live abroad and, you know, become like essentially kind of like a Randian hero in their own lives where they have no loyalty to any nation. And I mean, I understand the appeal of that because that was the appeal of Bitcoin to me very early on was the fact that no government could produce more of it or, freeze the accounts. And, but today, you know, that's less and less relevant to the way I think, you know, because, you know, dissidents, we require libertarian tools and techniques, but ideologically, you know, that sort of thing just doesn't line up with the way I think anymore. And so, but yeah, I haven't read the book. I will get back to you on that. I've actually got to look into what other people have written more recently. There's a book that I've been seeing discussed a lot recently among libertarians by, I believe it's by a guy named Jeff Booth. And he's been a guest on Preston Pish's podcast a while, but he wrote a book recently that's been getting a lot of play and people really seem to love it. And it's about Bitcoin. It's about essentially the nation state's relationship with productive individuals. And so I, you know, while I haven't read it myself, it's definitely something that I want to get and read. But yeah, that's essentially all I can say on that right now.
Okay. That's an honest answer. So thank you so much, Carl. And thank you, Archie, for the donation. Miko has sent in a question and I would love to get your take on this. What are your thoughts on art vandalism by environmental activists? Well, that's apropos of my recent Twitter strike, because I tweeted out that I support the death penalty for this kind of crime. If somebody is going to vandalize great artistic masterpieces, I honestly think we should deter that with extreme prejudice by simply supporting the death penalty for that kind of cultural vandalism on the highest level. There's only one Mona Lisa, there's only one Van Gogh Sunflowers, and on and on and on. We cannot allow these people, these arrogant, fanatical freaks, to attack these things in their self-righteous fits about made-up environmental problems. That's just insanity. There's only one Mona Lisa. There's no shortage of Greta Thunbergs out there. And I honestly think that we have to lay down the law and be extremely, extremely brutal in stopping this, in punishing this, punishing it with the highest penalty known to man. So anyway, I was told that no, Twitter doesn't allow you to advocate the death penalty for particular crimes. So what are your thoughts about this? So what would you do, Carl, about people who vandalize great art masterpieces in protest? Protest for anything, but in this case, it's these climate activists who are doing
this. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think I agree with you on this. I think that when you attack like a famous artwork, that's actually you're attacking the very foundation of a civilization, right? And you know, the same goes for this, you know, statues and architecture and buildings and things like that. It's these things are more than just the material they're made of. They're symbolic of the civilization itself. And so you are essentially saying my person and my ideas are more important than this moment of genius that this artist has come up with. And so, yeah, these paintings, they take on a significance that's above and beyond what they were when they were initially created. And for instance, you know, like the Mona Lisa, you know, was, I'm sure Leonardo da Vinci never would have guessed that that would have been considered among his greatest at the time. And it was just a thing that he had been commissioned to produce for a wealthy woman. But yeah, today it's a symbol of our race and, our civilization, despite not being a product of our civilization, it's something that led to us. So yeah, it's definitely, I have zero sympathy for what would happen to the people that would actually destroy something like that. I think that, you know, basically I would let the mob have fun with them.
Right. Absolutely. It's just when they were tearing down statues, they are tearing down Western civilization in effigy. They're burning Western civilization in effigy. They're burning white civilization in effigy. We have to treat that as an attack on our persons, because the next thing that will escalate to is just the outright destruction of white people physically. We should not allow these merely symbolic things. They're not merely symbolic. We can't allow them to be discounted as merely symbolic. Archie writes, related to what Greg is saying, is the rhetoric from progressive politicians that lives are more important than property while BLM was destroying businesses. And then they suddenly changed their rhetoric as soon as BLM began visiting the homes of politicians. This is absolutely true. And no, it's not just property. They're unique pinnacles of civilization. They're symbols of our civilization. They're irreplaceable, and they have to be treated with great respect. And the people who attack them have to be treated with the most extreme prejudice available. I just think that some things need to be sacred. Our race needs to be sacred.
It occurs to me now that this is actually very similar to what I've seen communists say. Communists, you know, we'll talk about, they'll justify theft on the basis that they'll say, is your property rights or your property rights more important than my right to life? You know, and they'll say, well, I need to steal this in order to survive or to live. And, you know, frankly, when you get right down to it, yes, your life is just not that valuable to me. And why should it be? You know, like, you know, if you or I were in a situation where we were dying, do you really think any of these leftists would consider that worthy of sacrificing their property for, you know, to save us? Of course not. You know, absolutely. So it's so yeah, you know, in you know, a rationalist, if you're entirely rationalist and you're ranking the value of things in the world, theoretically you should place human life above all else. But I don't buy that, you know, and I think that true rationalism makes room for some things to be worth more than human life.
Well, absolutely. And here's the thing, it's not just private property, it's all of our property. That's the thing that I think is important to understand about great works of art, literature, science, the whole heritage of civilization. Ultimately, it's our collective property, belongs to all of us. Yeah, of course, somebody's the custodian of that canvas or that sculpture, okay? And these things do have market value, they're traded. But I think that that doesn't fully capture what they are as a cultural heritage. They're beyond mere property. And yeah, these things are irreplaceable, whereas environmentalists are a dime a dozen. And this absolute humanism that we're supposed to embrace, well, radical environmentalists don't believe in that either, right? They think that the idea that man is more valuable than nature, just because we walk on two legs and, you know, have a quasi-rational brain, is rubbish. Well, I think the idea that these people have more value than great works of art is equally rubbish. Man is not such a, again, there's no shortage of human beings on this planet. There's some are endangered. Others are in great oversupply, but there's only one Van Gogh sunflowers. There's only one Vermeer girl with the pearl earring. And these things need to be treated as what they are. And we would be horrible custodians of our cultural legacy if we didn't do that.
Yeah. And in conclusion, humanism is a terrible method for ranking the value of things, right? Because humanism is always going to end up putting essentially genetic garbage at the top of the heap.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Carl, this has been great. I'm just glancing to see if there are more questions here for you. I'm not seeing any more. I really appreciate it. This hour has just flown by. It's been a ton of fun. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. All right.
How do people follow your work?
Well, right now I'm just on Telegram. And let's see, I always forget my channel name because I don't ever look and see what it is. But it's, let's see here. It is t.me/BitcoinBBQ. And so if you like barbecue, and so if you just join that channel, you can see my posts. And I try to post once or twice daily. I don't want to overload people too much, but I just post things that I find interesting or, you know, relevant to what we think about.
Yeah, I always appreciate your posts. I've been following your stuff for years on many, many platforms. This guy used to have one of the most brilliant Twitters around, and he was constantly being banned. And I want you to go back. I want you to go back.
I will. Yeah. I will. I think that, you know, now that Elon has finally taken it over, I think within the next week or two, I'll create a new account. And I'm going to try to encourage Alba Rising to create a new account too, because we miss him. And so, Alba and I, we go back a while, and I think that we kind of play ideas off of each other. And so, you know, we're a good combo on Twitter. So when I do create a new Twitter account, I will let everybody know, and I'll also link people to Alba's account too, so they could follow him.
Excellent. I want Woes to come back. I want Morgoth to come back. I want the whole the whole gang back on Twitter. I think that would be fantastic.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I am going to say goodbye and just
Thanks, Greg.
With a few philosophical questions here. Thank you so much.